Hello, this is the Torg Eternity Delphi Council Debriefings, where the storm has a name. We are your hosts, Mark and Lehman, and today we will be discussing NPCs. How, as a game master, you can make NPCs that your players love, how your NPCs that your players hate, and how to avoid making NPCs the opposite of what you plan. So if you want the players to love an NPC, the pitfalls that you can make for them to hate them, and vice versa. Other than that, you can email us at torgdcd@gmail.com. You can send us your questions. We'll answer to the best of our abilities. You can send us comments, and we'll comment on the comments. So we'll start off. Mark, how have you found making an NPC that the players love? Or maybe your pitfalls in making an NPC that you wanted your players to love, but they just hated.
Well, I don't know that I made NPCs that they would that I wanted them to love and that they would then hate, so much as I wanted them to have an attachment to this one over here, and that was the one they ignored and went for somebody else. Okay. Completely. And my problem frequently has been that you start because everybody that's not sitting at the table that your players' characters encounter are non-player characters. Mm-hmm. Hence the non-player character part, the NPC. And that means they're all mine. I have to be all of these people, right? The GM has to be all of these NPCs. And that becomes that sometimes is a daunting and overwhelming task. And I've seen some GMs where they'll sit back trying to prep for a game, and they get caught up in, I got to have this guy over here, and I got to have this gal over here, and I got to have this person over here, and what if they go over here? I don't have anybody over there. I'm like, you can world build yourself into a corner and never play the game because you're still trying to, dot the landscape with these NPCs. The challenge that becomes is being willing to sit down and say, here's a list of my important people that I absolutely have to build out first. And then if they go over, they decide, I've got a tavern over here and I got a shop over here. And now they want to go completely somewhere else for something that I had no idea, because players never do that.
Right.
Do something that you never planned for. And they want to, okay, well, I want to talk to that guy over there. Where do I find, I need a, all of a sudden they've bought a horse and now they want to put, I need a barding smith. I need a blacksmith to make barding. How did we get on a horse? Okay, whatever. So now that, where's this? Okay, here's the blacksmith. What's his name? That is the bane of GMs is the name of the PC. And I don't think the players really care what the name is.
But they want a name.
That the NPC has a name.
Right.
Right? And so to me, I always like to start with a name. And I have found that the players don't care if the name is any good, but the DMs, the GMs, the game master, we obsess over the name for the NPC, because that's not the right name for this NPC. A blacksmith shouldn't be named Lily. I mean, Lily might be a perfectly good name for a blacksmith, and in the case of your table. Mm-hmm. But as a GM, I'm like, I got this picture of this burly, overweight dude with a leather apron over and a beard that's got some pockmarks and a scar on one eye, and his name is Lily. Now, that doesn't fit the picture that I have in my mind, but I don't know what a good name for this guy is. Mm-hmm. And so, his name is Bob. Well, that's not a good name either. But I absolutely tell you that I ran a long-term, multi-year campaign. And the very first NPC that the player characters picked up as someone that was going to be a companion in that first level adventure, I threw out the name because I'm like, this guy will never stick around. They'll get him killed off, and I don't have to worry about him. His name is Bob. And they ran with it. His name was Bob. Bob was an integral part of the entire campaign, and he played a pivotal role in the final battle. And he was named Bob the entire time. So the name is, I start with the name. I like to have a good name. I like to have a good name. And modern our internet, you can find name generators for anybody you want. Right. So names are not as big a deal anymore. But I find that having a name out of the gate overcomes one of the biggest hurdles for your player characters to make a connection with an NPC. Now, I'm not going to say it's a good connection or a bad connection. At this stage of the discussion, it doesn't matter if they love them or hate them. You don't care. You just want them to connect. And that name is the first hurdle because they're going to ask for it, and you got to have it.
Right, and you just said the words for a completely different thing, but that's the key. You said they don't care. If you had that blacksmith, and they're like, what's his name? As a game master, if you said, oh, it doesn't matter, you know, just whatever, they're going to tune out.
Everything stops.
They're not going to care. You know, they'll just want to look in a book, look at the gear, equipment, and say, hey, can I buy this with how it is in the book? They don't want to interact any longer with that NPC. They just want to do stuff by the book because they no longer care. You give that NPC a name. Like you said, that's the very first thing that they want. Name generators, especially when I'm playing online, I'll have a tab just open at the beginning of the game. Boop, name, you know, random fantasy or whatever, name generator. And then they never know that I didn't come up with it if I hadn't come up with it, you know? And it's just because you just hit it. And even if you don't like what it's there, maybe it'll have a list of 10 and you like that first name with a letter different and that last name combined with this other last, you know, it at least gives you some ideas.
Or the six characters in the middle of it. You're like, oh, that sounds cool. Let me grab that.
Right. So it's not just taking off of the name generator. You can sometimes use that as inspiration because a lot of times that's the question that the game master gets stuck on. I have also found where you'll put an NPC into a game and your players will avoid the NPC at all cost. They will find that other nondescript person and that's the one that, you know, they want to form a connection with. Torg Eternity is a little different, and it can help you with connection cards because that's not really something in other games. And I found that when a player plays a connection card and you come up with that NPC, since they've played it, and then you say, you know, in my original Torg, classic Torg game, one of the characters was a monkey wrench. His name was Wrench. He was a mechanic. From the South, and he played a connection card, and they were doing something around New Orleans, and he had Bubba came up, a local police officer that they, you know, went to high school together. And, you know, that's all I had to say was, you know, hey, it's your high school, you know, your old high school pal Bubba, who's now a police officer. And, you know, that became a long lasting NPC that wasn't always there. But anytime they were in that area, they had that connection, and you know that connection would be brought back. That's something that happens with any of those social cards, like romance. If a player plays a romance card and that romance NPC comes up, then they're the ones who initiated it. So I have found that that helps out a lot. Same thing with nemesis for the hate side of things. If they've played the nemesis card, their nemesis comes up, it gives them a little more of a direct connection there. So in Torg Eternity, Game Masters, you can use those. And depending, again, we've talked about this many times, I'm on the Delphi Council debriefings, is depending on your group, if you're, like Mark does, a lot of organized play, or if you're at your home game, there can be differences. But in my home games, somebody plays a romance card, it's not a, I play the romance card on this NPC, because maybe that's not available. I will just write down romance, you know, that person, the player's name, character name, and romance, and then I will have that pop up later if it's not right then appropriate. And that's helped me as a game master be able to introduce things a little more organically. But if you're in a time limit, or a, hey, this is just a one-shot thing, or a short series of adventures, then you might need to use those cards a little more on the moment instead of waiting for later, because they can also stack up. But any of those social type connection, romance, nemesis, even the mistaken identity every once in a while, if somebody's the one who figured it out, you get unmasked and they've seen you, any of that type of stuff can create some really interesting bonds between the players, and I mean the players, mm-hmm. and their interaction between the characters that they're playing and the NPCs, which is the main thing of this episode, because in my opinion, the worst NPC is the NPC that they don't care about as a player and they don't remember. There are many games, different settings, different systems that I can remember my character, I can remember the other players' characters, and I cannot remember any plots, I cannot remember any NPCs, because there was no connection there. And the ones that people remember are the ones that are the, for me, the ones that then that fills out, and then they remember those sessions, and then they remember those plot lines, and they get more invested in things. So what else would you have to say about hating, loving, getting your players invested in those NPCs?
Well, so once you got the name, right, you're over the first hurdle. Now you can have a conversation with Harold, Bob, Jane, Ephevrin, whatever the name happens to be. And that gives you something to anchor who that player character, that NPC is. One of the ways you can help your players build that connection with an NPC or make them into something that they like or hate is if the NPC causes your players to, or your players to have to expend resources one way or the other,
mm-hmm.
they're now interacting with the plot of the story. The game, they have become a part of the game, because you know, if they say something and I don't think I believe him, okay, well, why don't you give me an insight roll to see, or whatever perception or whatever you want to call for, whatever your game calls for, to understand evidence analysis, however you want to look at it, or it's, you know what, why don't you set me a DN on Trick, because you don't know and we'll figure it out. Or here's the number. Roll me a trick to see if you see through this ruse, or if he's even telling the truth. Once they start rolling dice to interact with the NPC, they begin to think more about the NPC, him or herself, and they give the NPC depth at that point, because now they're what-ifing. Well, okay, I'm looking at our blacksmith. Is he strong? Is he smart? Is he capable of lying? What do I know from the interaction I've had with the game master so far as to what he said? Is he trying to trick? Do I think from what the game master has said that he's trying to trick me, or you know, they're adding depth to that NPC on their own as they what if what's going on, which kind of leads me into, if you as the game master want your NPCs to have that depth, you have to give it to them. So you have to know who those NPCs are, and that there's a lot of different tools you can use to do that. You can write your NPC a little backstory. You can completely, like, I've got a, over on one of my screens, I've got a character sheet open in Roll20 that's showing me all the skills in a character sheet, because that's how, you know, if I were going to build an NPC for a Torg game, I would open this character sheet and start filling it out. Well, if you know what the attributes are, charisma, dexterity, mind, spirit, strength, all that, you know, is our blacksmith smart? Is he strong? Is he charismatic? You know, where it does he stumble around the forge, or is he nimbly hopping to and fro? You know who the character is. You can describe that character or answer the questions, because you can't think of everything, right? But if you have this image of, when I see Bob the blacksmith and I see that name on the character sheet, I remember when I build my characters, I have this image in my head of who that character is, so that I can answer the questions the character sheet is asking me. Does this character need energy weapons, fire combat, heavy weapons, melee, whatever? Air vehicles, is that an appropriate skill from our blacksmith? Alteration magic, apportation, is he a magical blacksmith? You know, those questions, you start to flesh out the character as you build them, so that when the players interact with him, somebody says, hey, I need magical barding for our horse. You already know you gave your blacksmith a couple of ads in alteration magic, so that he can imbue that, you maybe, and you're like, yes, he actually, you see some runes that he's scribing on the piece he's working on right now. So yeah, you can tell, you already have those answers if you've built it out. The flip side of that, but that locks you into some things about your character. The flip side of that is, if you want to be flexible with it and say, well, I know who the concept is of my blacksmith. He's a blacksmith. He just makes armor, barding, weapons, that kind of thing. But he doesn't have any magic, blah, blah, blah. But you don't need anything else. You can let the players, when they come up and say, I need magical barding, well, I hadn't considered that. Now you can answer that, but you have to be quick. As a GM, you have to be quick, because you have to decide right on the fly, is this blacksmith going to be a magical blacksmith or not? Because when you answer the question, they're going to take that and run with it, and they're going to assume you have your blacksmith all fleshed out. Well, you're not. You're letting them determine it. You're going to answer the questions. So you got to make notes quick and then come back to them later. Nothing wrong with that, and it gives you a lot of flexibility to fill the need that you see as the game master in your cosm for what you need in this particular situation. And you can fill it or not as the story dictates, which is great flexibility. You just have to be real quick with your answers and know who your NPCs are in order to be able to do it. But letting them cause your players to expend resources in a positive or negative way is a great way to start building a memorable NPC with them, so that when, you know, if they're combative with the NPC, they might dislike them. If the NPC is providing them something that they need, in other words, helping them, they might like them. And so, but they're interacting with the stories at that point. Expending cards or making them roll dice also is another way to anchor to them and flesh out who they are and build that rapport, so that they start caring about that NPC, because now they know what the PC or NPC provides. So the next time they need it, they can come back. Or, hey, we got to find Bob. And now it's even a tool that you can put Bob the blacksmith at risk. Right? And, well, you know what? Bob built these. We need more barding, or we got to find out. Yeah, we got a guy that does that. We'll go get you to do that. And you come back. Oh, he's kidnapped. Oh, we got to go save Bob. Right? They care about Bob because they wanted something from him because he did a good job. But he's been kidnapped. You kidnapped him.
Mm-hmm.
Right? For the story. And then that moves forward, and now there's even greater, put him at risk. There's even greater connection. But they don't, unless they care about him in the first place, they're not going to care if you put him at risk.
Right.
So causing them to interact with him with dice helps build that rapport.
I will second that, and I'll go into a specific Torg example that I use. But the very first thing I want to do is... Jay couldn't be here for this recording, but he did in chat that we have, he put in my two cents, and I remember him talking about this on a different episode, but he says, have them compliment the NPCs on something. It's obvious, but incredibly tends to work. And the opposite I have found works. If you have an NPC make a snide comment or act a little superior, that group is going to hate them. I know in Torg Eternity, there's, I can't remember the name, but it's a doctor of the main person over one of the Delphi Council branches. that is like a snob and was in the beginning of Unhallowed Data, gives them the mission and basically is all superior. And that is a way to make your players hate that character, hate that division. And if you want that to happen, that's fine. But if you don't want that to happen, that's something that you might look at, because there are a lot of snide. Like, I believe the character said something like, okay, now who is the second most intelligent person in this room? You know, already putting down everybody as he considers himself the most intelligent. So, the flip side is what Jay said. If you want somebody to like, if you have an NPC and you want your characters to like them, have that NPC compliment them. If you want your players to hate an NPC, have that NPC make a snide comment, have a little superiority over them, degrade them, something like that, and that will absolutely turn the players one way or another. My actual Torg example is, again, a classic Torg. When I was first making my group, it was one of the very few games that I was a player first, and then I was in university, and then for summer break came back and was like, hey, I want to do this game. And then I started game mastering Torg. And then I was introducing two new people to it. And there was only two people, only two players. And at that time, I had started to learn. It took me way too long, but I had started to learn that GMPCs are not good. Because I always was a game master, and I always wanted to be able to play too. So let me, slide my GMPC into the party, and so that I could participate on both sides of things. That usually goes bad. Because players will consider anything that GMPC says to be like you pushing them, railroading them. Anytime that GMPC does something super and spectacular, they're like, oh, he's just, that's because that's his NPC. So you really have to have your players' trust. And Torg, what had happened is the players, they only had two. And I was like, okay, everybody can make two characters, but they only wanted to play one character, and they were said that they were fine with a GMPC. So I introduced two GMPCs, and it was the one time that they actually liked the NPCs, threw some romances out there to, and then back then you had the campaign card, so they would last the entire time. And 30 years later, my player, whose character, the ninja Yakamoto, and Speranza the Amazon are a couple. It's been going on forever because of that. But one of the things that happened is once the group became more people, then those NPCs stepped away because they weren't needed to kind of bolster up the ranks of the Storm Knights. But they would appear every once in a while, and then that campaign, that connection would come into play and do things like that. And then I did the kidnap. She got kidnapped. And that made the NPC that kidnapped her, the player then saved a nemesis card. This is who I'm, this is my nemesis.
Nice.
It made it personal, and they rescued her. She went out, then she joined the party temporary to get the revenge, because she's a capable warrior by herself. She just, got waylaid and kidnapped. It wasn't the helpless damsel in distress kidnapped. It was, I got snuck up on, otherwise I would have beheaded the guy, kidnapped. They went after for vengeance, and every time that NPC, they would hear his name, that player hated him. That player, you could just see the raw anger in his voice. And that was one of the things, if you can get a player to, and again, a player. If you can get a player to care about an NPC, then anybody that goes against that NPC, you're going to be able to get that player to hate that NPC. And in a good way, because the bad way of hate is, in games, is the, I hated that NPC because I didn't care about him. He was a bad NPC. He, you know, why was he there? What was his goals? What was his plans? I don't know, and I don't care. You know, so I hate that NPC. Now, if you're, I hate that NPC because he did this, this, and this, and I'm emotional about that, then you can get some really good and rich stories into it. And that was just one of the things that have come out of Torg that was really cool. The other one that is weird, but I hear it happens a lot, and it's definitely happened in my game, is when you have, like, the base enemy, the lowest type of enemy. So, say, in fantasy, you would have, like, a goblin or a kobold, and the party, like, defeats all of them, leaves one guy alive, and that kobold or goblin gets adopted by the party. There seems like there's so many games out there that I've heard of the, you know, the adopted kobold or goblin that you kind of become a sidekick, and you can have NPCs as sidekicks if the player comes up with it. If you try to attach a sidekick and it doesn't seem organic, if it seems like you're a player pushing this sidekick, they're not going to like them. They're going to see this thing is annoying. The sidekick is, no, you stay at home. We don't want you here. If they're the ones who take it upon themselves, hey, this guy's pretty cool, or our game master, we know you would just rather us defeat all the enemy and go off, but, you know, we're gonna adopt this little kobold, this little goblin, or whatever, depending on the reality that you're in, then they're going to get attached to that. And that's just something that I've seen over time, that I, as a game master, have never planned on. And it pops up every now and then of just the, this is the NPC we've adopted. And it's just very, very, very fun. And then you can roll with it as you're, you know, as a game master, don't go, oh, they did something that I wasn't thinking about. I'm going to say, no, you can't do this. Bring it in, allow it to happen, because that's going to get your players invested in it. So, Mark, what are some other thoughts you have on NPCs?
Well, so I'm going to disagree with you on the GM NPC.
Okay.
My home group that I played with fantasy setting for decades is just my wife. Me and my wife, mm-hmm. and my buddy and his wife. And so that puts me as the GM with the three players. And that always left one role unfilled. Because right. your typical in D&D 3.0 and whatever, cleric, fighter, magic user, thief, mm-hmm. right? Four basic roles. And I could tell you who everybody's going to play, which leaves one role unfilled. And so I would always slip one NPC in as that, whatever they didn't want to play, boom, we'd put one in there, and that was the other, that was an NPC, and it wasn't my character per se, it was an NPC. Mm-hmm. And the way that I made that work, so that, like you said, there is that risk, there's absolutely the risk that people look at it and go, oh, you're showing favoritism to your character, and it's you know, that's why they're always doing well, this, that, and the other. I always had one of the other players run the NPC, mm-hmm. with the caveat that occasionally I would say, no, that's not appropriate. They wouldn't do that. He wouldn't do that. She wouldn't do that. Or speak for that NPC, mm-hmm. when it's appropriate based on, and the nice thing that allows me to do as a GM or as a DM in this case, is I've always got a conduit into the party. And I can always drop something in. If they're going in a completely wrong direction, I can drop a hint through the NPC who says something. Or if they're going in the absolute right direction and I want to try to, you know, throw them off or something, they can say something else, or you just let them be quiet.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge becomes not is being the DM and not being the character and just letting them run the character, and then it becomes an NPC. It's a complete NPC if somebody else is running that sheet of paper, rolling mm-hmm. hit, rolling attack rolls, and taking damage and making saves and doing all the rest of it as a bookkeeping affair. And oh hey, yeah, Bob's gonna heal or whatever. A lot of times it was the healer. Nobody wanted to be the cleric,
right.
So we would put a cleric on paper and then, oh okay, Bob's gonna heal you, or Bob's gonna do this. And he's a hit point battery, and that was really all he did there, as long as you kept him alive. And they were invested in him because he healed them. Had to keep him alive. If you couldn't keep him alive, he wasn't there to heal you. And so they would, you know, they would keep the cleric alive for that reason.
I'll say, just to bring up, in both of our cases that they worked, we had a low population of players.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I would caution, the more players you get, the less accepted that is, or the less...
Well, I don't...
You know, the less your players are going to like that GM.
I don't do it as a course of action when I've got a full table.
Right.
And by full table, I typically... 4 is my number. I've run one-on-one where it's DM and one player.
Right, yep.
I've done that. I don't like to do that. To me, a table is 4 players. If you've got 3 or you've got 2, then play. That's the playing is important. You play it the way you can get the play done. But to me, 4 is a table. I'm not going to insert an NPC into 4 as a need, because mm-hmm. 4 is enough to you've got enough to spread load attacks incoming, so that not one person just, you know, beat down. You've got enough to be able to take care of an assortment of skills and abilities to address any issues that come up, etc. So I don't have a DM PC
right.
in the group for that. There might be an NPC that's story driven.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is the guy that gave you the quest, and he's coming along because, you know, yes, you're hardened adventurers and you know what's up, and this guy's a fop.
Right.
And he insists that you take him because he's paying you, and how dare you? And, you know, now he's a problem. He's baggage. He's part of the story. He's not my character, an NPC mm-hmm. that helps the party. He's part of the story. He's why you're there. So that's appropriate. And I do that. And that's when we get to the, you know, loving and hating part. You know, who's the NPC and why is he there? I've found that if you force the NPC on the group, by definition, they're going to be against him,
right,
or her. If you must take this NPC with you, they will not like the NPC. They'll start out not liking the NPC. Now the story might drive them to like the NPC eventually, but their initial reaction is going to be, well, we didn't want to take you.
Mm-hmm.
Now we got a split experience. We got a split treasure. You're going to get FaceTime. You're going to roll dice. You're going to get all these other things. You might kill steal. You might cause problems rather than solve problems. You might steal treasure. We don't know who you are, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's all kinds of unknowns
right.
with that situation, and they're going to be resistant to it. The flip side of it is, if you make them want to find the PC, like we're going after, you know, we have to go find the wizard. Or so-and-so's been abducted and we got to go save so-and-so. Or we need to find the alchemist to make a specific potion so we can get this king to cure malady for this king, so that the king will allow us to pass through his lands to go do something else. Well, now they care about the alchemist because they got to go find the alchemist. Mm-hmm. They don't know who the alchemist is, but they care about him because they're expending effort, time, and resources to go find him. Because they have a need. You've created a memorable NPC that they haven't even met yet because they're pursuing him or her. And when they get there, they'll determine whether they like him or not, or like her or not. And it won't matter because they know what they're capable of providing into the setting. And then the next time they have a need, the first person they're going to think about is that alchemist, whether they like him or not.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody's going to go, oh, I hated that guy. Or, oh, you know what? They were really helpful. And then they'll play off of that. But that name will come up again. And it'll come up because you made them go to that person. It's like this, and it won't matter who it is. You didn't even tell them the name. You got to go find an alchemist to make this magical draught for the king. You know, you might have four towns out there and you don't even know which town they're going to decide to go to. And will it matter? No, because they don't know whether there's an alchemist there or not, or they might, depending on whether you put one there. But if they decide, let's go see if in, you know, Journeyville, there's an alchemist. Again, you as the GM, you got to decide, did I put an alchemist there or not? Is it appropriate to have one there or not? If I put one there, what kind of alchemist is there?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you answer those questions will determine in your own mind without telling them anything whether or not there's one there. Or maybe they're like, I don't want them in that part of the game world at all, because that just is completely inappropriate for the next phase of what they're going to do. And so now you've got a different NPC that might be a throwaway. Oh, I heard there's an alchemist in so-and-so place. And I overheard this and I thought this would be helpful. And the problem you run into then is that they get attached to that person that was a throwaway, and now you got them traipsing around with them for 3 years.
Right.
And you never, like, oh, crap, how do I – and you got to make somebody up on the fly. But the point is, you can control all of that by making them want to go there or forcing somebody on them, depending on how you want them to look at that NPC.
Right. Let's – go to another example of the hate NPC.
Okay.
One of the things and that happens in Torg Eternity and a lot of other games is you want to have whoever the main villain is. You want them, but to show up, but there's always the chance that when they show up, the players are going to get some really good rolls in. They're going to defeat the main bad guy. There's that chance that it can happen. And then you either have to make up another bad guy and say, oh, this one was a lieutenant or whatever. But there are ways, and you wouldn't want to use it very often, but there's a nice way that I found to get your bad guy, get the players invested in the villain without a necessary first fight, but they'll be really gunning to get to the villain so that they can get the final fight. As an example, I had party. They're in Isle, so we're nowhere close to, like, Cyber Papacy or Pan Pacifica, which as soon as you start introducing NPCs, people are thinking, oh, they're going to turn on us. You know, you have those tropes in Pan Pacifica and Cyber Papacy.
They are going to turn on you.
You know, they will. So you set this in a different reality, like Isle. And you have your players, they get to the village. The village has the problem. Okay, there's a bunch of lurks nearby. And since it's high fantasy, you got a dungeon too. But okay, over in these caves, there are some lurks, and they've been raiding the town, and the town, you know, sees you as adventurers, and they're like, hey, could you do this thing? You know, a couple of days ago, a elf warden, you know, said that she would take care of it, but they've raided since then. And so the party goes off, and they encounter the lurks fighting the elf warden, and they come in. The elf warden works with the party, defeats the lurks. So the elf didn't show up the party. You know, it wasn't like you made it so that it was unbeatable, and the elf warden rescued the party. You have it flipped the other way. I found that players get more good feelings if they're the ones who helped the NPC rather than the other way around. The anti Deus Machina, where you just, you know, the thing comes out and it saves the party. You can do that once or twice, but the parties tend to resent that as a whole. So the party talks with the Elf Warden. They go back, and then another, you know, because we're in Isle, darkness is coming, so there's another threat that's out there. They go out, and they defeat that threat together. So they're working together. So the party is building rapport with this Elf Warden. So they go back to town in the tavern, talking and stuff. And then there is mention of some weird stuff going on in the cemetery. So the party's like, oh, there's going to be some undead or gospog or something is going on in the cemetery. So let's investigate that. So they get into the cemetery, and then that's when the Elf Warden drops her facade and reveals herself to be a necromancer who then raises the dead, has them attack the party. She's a magic user, so then she uses, while the party's still shocked, she uses something to escape. And now she's the main villain at the bottom of the dungeon. And now, instead of having a main villain at the bottom of a dungeon that the party's only been told about by the town folk and don't really have an investment in, now they had somebody that they trusted, they had built rapport with, they thought they were friends, and then they got betrayed, not in Pan Pacifica. You know, because in Pan Pacifica they would have been expecting it the entire time. But in Isle, High Fantasy, you don't necessarily expect that. And when I pulled that thing into the story, man, they wanted to get to that bottom of that dungeon as fast as they could to, you know, defeat that villain. And that just brought a lot of that hate, where you take a like, you take a love, and you flip it because they were betrayed. And it felt more organic because the party was the ones who, they rescued her, they took her on another mission. You know, they were the ones. It wasn't me forcing that NPC onto the party. It was the party seeking out that NPC to go along with them. And then you have the flip, the betrayal in Isle happen, and it just provided a lot more emotion, and the players, you know, it's one of those things where the players still remember and the players still talk about, and that's the adventures that stick are the ones that they are invested in. So do you have any personal stories of anything, Torg or otherwise, where players might have flipped their love to hate, or their hate to love?
Well, so I guess we used in one of the early adventures that Rod and I wrote for Torganized Play. It was a two-parter, and we ran it at Dragon Con, second year out, was the spider, and we set up the spider as this Nile Empire villain, and in the culmination of the two adventures, you face off with the spider in his lair, and he's got this concubine with him that is, when the fight starts, the spider jumps up and starts fighting, and the concubine, there were two concubines, scurry away to try and get out of the way. Well, in the second or third or fourth round of the combat, you discover that the spider isn't really the bad guy. Mm-hmm. The spider, the real spider was the concubine who scurried away and got on an undersea scooter to escape and was mind controlling this dupe that was her stand in to draw fire. Right. You can only do something like that so often.
Mm-hmm.
And the players will, when they walk into a room, they'll start, okay, this is what he did last time. So, and now they're suspicious, right? It's metagaming,
right.
Sure, but the best villains work the best when the players don't know what's going on. Like your warden, when they you know, ha ha, and she reveals herself, and everybody goes, wait, what? And that's the reaction you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that players who've been playing for any length of time at all view every NPC for the most part as a red shirt, as a potential traitor.
Mm-hmm.
And until they establish that they aren't, they still have this suspicious bone about them. And I mean, a lot of times they never get rid of it. You know, they're just always kind of out of the side of their eye. They're like, I'm watching you. I'm keeping my eye on you. Even when they're like, you as the GM are like, oh, you know, I'm not, that's all the actions over here. I have no intention of doing anything with those guys over there. And the players are still going, I don't trust that guy. So you got to be careful with that. You can't, like you're talking about, you can't do the subtlety thing and the traitorous reveal kind of stuff all the time. It's, you know, we as GMs love it when the players go, oh, wait, what? And you catch them off guard. But sometimes the only way that works is if you give them, you know, standard fare with regularity and sneak something in every now and then. Like you have an open necromancer who was spotted standing in the graveyard raising the dead, and now there's an army of the dead, you know, besetting the town, and you can find the necromancer over here, and she's got these minions that are working for her, and you go over there and there she is, and you know, you kill her and you've solved the problem. That's very straightforward. It mm-hmm. seems a little railroady. It's not. It's so straightforward that it feels like a railroad. All right, because it's a straight line. There's no lefts and rights. There's no questions. It just falls into place, and you can use those to your advantage to lull the players into complacency and then start slipping other things in there because they get used to that straightforward stuff. The escapes, when you can, like when the spider escaped, or when your elven warden, now necromancer, escapes, when the players are like, we're going to kill her, and they can't, now they're invested in that bad guy.
Right.
And a good bad guy should not be thrown away lightly.
Mm-hmm.
And by thrown away, I mean dealt with. You can get a lot of plot out of a good bad guy, which is the whole point of this episode, right? And part of the way that you do that is knowing what your bad guy is good at being bad at.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to catch them somehow at being the bad guy. They walk onto a scene of an atrocity with obvious evidence of, you know, a witness saw them there, or one of the henchmen you capture, or someone who's just about their dying words are whatever, or, you know, video evidence or some such thing that implicates the bad guy, knowing that your bad guy is bad because you called him a bad guy or a bad right. gal. I'm using that as a generic term.
Right.
Your villain has to be bad. If it's mm-hmm. if the villain is going to be viewed as the bad guy, they have to be bad. And you should know what they're bad at. You should know how they're bad at it. And by that, I mean being good at being bad. Right? So how do you do that? How do they do that? And that in order to – this is the art form of the GM. You have to walk a very fine line of – because the villain has to be – a threat to the party.
Mm-hmm.
If they're not a threat to the party, then mundane sources would deal with this particular threat. So they have this villain has to be bad enough that the average law and order mundane forces in the area cannot deal with them. And so they need the heroes, specific brand of heroism, to deal with this bad guy, right? So you've got this sweet spot that your bad guy has to fit in. Just bad enough so that the locals can't deal with them. Not so bad that they squash your heroes.
Right.
Because if they can just crush the heroes, then why are they running from the heroes, hiding from the heroes, or whatever? They're just going to go, oh, they're looking for me? Okay, let me come over here and deal with you. Squash. And now the heroes are no longer a threat, and I go back to what I was doing. So you can't make them uber powerful. You have to have them right there in that sweet spot to where the heroes have to be a threat. And so I can't ignore them as the bad guy. I have to deal with them. One of the ways that you make sure that you get your recurring bad guy, in my opinion, is to have a good lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
And everything about what makes a good bad guy good works for a lieutenant. You just scale the power down. And the lieutenant is towards the end of the whatever segment your mission adventure scenario is shaped into, the lieutenant's the one that the bad guy shoves at the heroes so that he can get away. And you end up defeating the lieutenant, and the bad guy gets away. You can only do that once or twice.
Mm-hmm.
So if you got to set up layers of these bad guys, or these lieutenants, of these levels, right? So you get the mooks. In Torg Eternity terms, you got the mooks that are like Batman. In the 60s, campy Batman.
Right. There's always the minions.
They always had the minions running around in whatever outfit was appropriate for whatever villain they served, right? And so your bad guy has some minions. And then the lieutenant has some minions. And there might be, in the minions, there might be one minion that stands out.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so that's kind of the lieutenant's lieutenant. And you make that one guy just a little bit better than the heroes. And so the heroes can take him out, get that sense of satisfaction and completion. And the lieutenant, those two become the focal point that the bad guy leaves. I'm leaving you in charge, and then goes away. And that's how your bad guy doesn't get wiped out in the beginning. Because that's the biggest threat with the Nile.
Right.
Is if you put your villain in the same room as the heroes inevitably are going to beat your villain.
Yep.
Every single time. But regardless of how powerful you make them, short of making them Mobius, at which point they just squash the heroes and it doesn't matter anymore, the heroes are going to spend possibilities, find a way to get to defeat the villain. The nice thing about the Nile Empire is that you got the law of inevitable return. So you can bring your hero back, or your villain back. That kind of gets trite, though, because they keep beating him and beating him and beating him. Doesn't work in any other cosm. So if you put, but the rule is still the same. You put your bad guy in the same room with the Storm Knights, and the Storm Knights are going to beat your bad guy. So you have to be prepared for that.
Even if you prepare, or you'll read an adventure that will say something like, when the villain takes a wound, they will fly away, or they'll... Your Storm Knights, the players, the dice are going to roll. There's going to be explosions. The villain's going to take 4 or 5 wounds and then roll a 1 to soak and not have a second. You know, I that will happen. We have video evidence of that happening. So, yes, you want to introduce the villain to give that connection, that bad connection, but you want to have the villain be able to escape in a way that fits your game. And what I mean there is, like, when I had the Elf Warden, you know, drop the facade, I'm a necromancer, when she teleported away, she clutched like a necklace and broke a crystal. Okay? What that told the players is, oh, that was a one-time use. So it's not going to happen every time, because that would get old. If every time they face the big villain, is just teleport away, teleport away, teleport away, teleport away. You know, so I gave them the hope of, okay, she's used this item. Unless she has another one of these items, that's not going to be on the table anymore. So that's also something, and again, unless you're Nile Empire and they always come back.
Except you, if you set it up where the villain teleports away, now that the player, you have that happen a couple times, and it's like you can't stop it initially, and just teleport away. Okay, well now, but now we know what your shtick is,
Right.
right? So now we've got to, if we want to beat you, we have to come up with a way to stop the teleportation thing. Well, in the Nile Empire, you employ weird science, and as the game master, you throw a weird Delphi Council weird scientist at him.
Right.
So here's a flanking Gurker that if you can get this set up in four corners of the room and activate it, she won't be able to teleport away. You set something like that up that they have a shot.
Yeah, and that would also, again, as we've stated many times, it's going to depend on is this a one act session that I'm playing at a con that is going to end, or is this a long running game that I can make it as long as I want? I don't have a time limit. So yeah, if they have something like that, you can set it up that the villain keeps doing this, you as player characters are going to have to figure out a counter to that, and then that becomes part of the adventure. That's a good setup. But if you have a time limit and people are, looking at their watches going, okay, the session's supposed to end, and then that feels very flat, like the game master is just, taking a toy away from a little kid, dangling in front of him. Hey, you want this? Nope, you can't have it. You want this? Nope, you can't have it. So I want to bring in another real scenario that happened was, I've said before I don't use the Delphi Council in my home game, but I have a Circle of Knights, a Circle of Storm Knights, and there's various Storm Knights group, and in this case, it was similar but different enough from the Elven Warder, or the Warden, is a couple of the Storm Knight groups go missing, or individuals within the groups go missing. Storm Knights go out, they rescue a few, they find a few that just had went to do their own thing. They weren't necessarily captured or anything. They were just doing their own mission and hadn't returned. So they're finding these missing Storm Knights, bringing them back or bringing back messages, hey, they're all right and stuff. And they are working with the Storm Knight groups. So they're part of that Storm Knight larger circle. So say you're part of the Delphi Council, or your Storm Knight group, part of a Delphi Council. There's other Storm Knight groups out there. You're rescuing some of them, you're finding some of them, but as the Delphi Council, you're all working together, and you can get some good relationships between your player characters and the Delphi Council NPCs. Then I have the player characters meet up with an entire group of one of the Storm Knight groups, and they're together, and another Storm Knight, and I put in quotations, one of the Storm Knight groups comes in. They weren't actual Storm Knights. They were Stormers who had infiltrated the Delphi Council. They knew that the other Storm Knight group was there. They didn't realize that the player Storm Knights were going to arrive at the same time they did. They attack the Storm Knights, the fake Storm Knights, the Stormers attack the Storm Knight NPC group and the PC group, and then you can have some. Okay, now we're two Storm Knight groups. We defeat the Stormer group, so we did the good thing, and then that can create a good, really good solid bond between your Storm Knight group, the player character Storm Knight group, and the NPC Storm Knight group, because they've done something really cool together. The other Storm Knight group didn't show up the players, and the players didn't show up the other Storm Knight group. They worked as equals, and I've been able to pull that off rather well. That was able to get those really good, nice bonds of your players having emotional ties to NPCs through their PCs that are the to me that's the greatest thing about the storytelling is when you have your players invested in your game because again, the last thing I want my players is to not remember anything because they don't care. I just rolled some dice. I think we won. You know, 10 years down the line, I want them to be like, that was cool because of this thing I remembered, and this villain I remembered, and this friend I remembered, and this NPC that was really cool. I don't want them 5 years, 10 years down the line going, yeah, I made a Cyber Knight. And I think Anthony played a martial artist, and Amy was a monster hunter, but I don't know what we did. We did some good stuff, I guess. That's not what you want the players to come away from the game with. You want to give them the moments that they can say, yes, this specific thing happened, and we were able to fight this specific hero, the specific villain, and all you have to do is say that villain's name 5-10 years, and a discussion automatically pops up. Because they were invested in the NPC, and it created a memory that lasts. So do you have any last tidbits before we wrap up?
Building memorable NPCs that your players or your players remember is there's an art to it. It's gonna take some thought, and mm-hmm. sometimes it just happens.
Yep.
And it's really cool when it just organically happens. I would say, regardless of how you try to make it work, be flexible and watch and listen to the way that your players interact with your NPCs, because they're gonna tell you which ones they want to interact with and the ones that they care about. And if you're a good GM and you just quietly listen to them, you'll be able to get the hints of which ones matter and which ones you can tinker with and how.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll do most of the work for you. You just have to nudge here and there and add a little color here and there and a little detail here and there, and they'll do most of the work for you.
Yep, I agree. So hopefully after this episode, we're able to get some ideas on how to make your villains memorable, how to make your NPCs memorable, some pitfalls to maybe watch out for, and some ways to allow the players to figure out what NPCs they like, then you're flexible enough to be able to go with them. So having said that, you can email us at torgdcd@gmail.com. Ask us questions. We'll answer your questions to the best of our ability. Leave comments, and we will comment back. But until next time, we hope you have fun in your own Cosmverse. Bye.